Welcome to The Cauldron with your host, Dr. Barry Goff, where we stir through the turbulent currents of Canadian history, those moments where ideologies clashed, tensions boiled, and our national character was forged or fractured in the heat of conflict. In this episode, we journey back to Vancouver in 1914, a city on the Pacific Rim and at the heart of a rising storm. Immigration, empire, and race colliding at the water's edge. It was the arrival of a single ship, the Comagata Maru, that laid bare the contradictions of a dominion proud of its British ideals, yet bound by a growing anxiety, the fear of the other. Aboard were 376 passengers, Sikhs, Muslims, Hindus, all British subjects from India seeking the promise of opportunity only to be met with a wall of hostility, legal obstruction, and open racism. This was not just a maritime dispute or a case of bureaucratic policy. It was a crisis of conscience, and it happened in full view of the city, the country, and the empire. Today, we explore the deeper currents beneath the surface, the racial tensions brewing in British Columbia, the fear of the so-called Hindu invasion, and how a quiet harbor became a battlefield for civil rights, colonial loyalty, and Canadian identity. Join Dr. Goff as we uncover the story of the Comagata Maru, not just an incident, but as a mirror to a country still struggling with who belongs. This is The Cauldron.
Our subject today in the Cauldron series is a subject which at one time was very little known, but now is a commanding presence in the history of race relations in British Columbia before the First World War. And the shadow of it continues to glide over current relationships between ethnicities and races in British Columbia. Indeed, it also influences and has something to do with the rivalry that exists between Sikhs and Hindus in the province of British Columbia. You'll remember perhaps the famous Air India bombing. It's the largest disaster in British Columbia history and one of the largest in Canadian history as well, and the legal fallout that came in relationship to that. You'll have heard of the Golden Temple at Amritsar. You'll have heard of General Dyer's 1919 stepping out of line in terms of military law in regards to an episode at Amritsar. And you will have heard perhaps of the two Anglo-Sikh wars, the second one of which involved our Governor Richard Blanchard, and that came to a close in 1849 through to 1854. The Punjab, which is dominated by Sikh nationals, was absorbed into the British India, part of the British Empire, by those two Anglo-Sikh wars. And in consequence of that, the Punjab became an integral part of British India. But the sectarian and religious interests of those people who were related in language and in religion began to be of a different point of view from the specific divisions that occurred when India was partitioned in 1947. The rush for the division of the Asian subcontinent between the Dominion of India, later the government and Republic of India on the one hand, and Pakistan on the other, is the stuff of great modern history, and it continues to be something of great tension. The cross-border arrangements were never clean. The refugee problems on both sides were terrible, and millions were lost and the Sikhs were caught in the jam of this. Now, out of this push for nationhood arose a consciousness for the Sikhs to develop their own state, and it's called Khalistan. Khalistan continues to be mentioned in the Canadian press as an ambition of the Sikh people. Our story in this part of the cauldron goes back to the warm summer of July of 1914, when a vessel registered as the Komagata Maru, Maru in Japanese means ship, and Komagata was its preliminary name, so Komagata Maru, arrived in Vancouver Harbor and came along at dockside to unload a large cargo of would-be immigrants. The Maru was eventually moored in the harbor, and on board were 376 East Indians. I'm reading from Margaret Ormsby's classic history. No one in Vancouver wanted to admit any more Hindus. The strangely alien and supposedly subversive British subjects who competed with white men in the lumber mills on the Fraser River. And no one wanted a repetition of the trouble of 1907, when damage amounting to $36,000 had been done to Chinese and Japanese property. Just a side note on that. In another episode in the podcast series of The Cauldron, I have explained in detail about how opium became a central factor in a new law that Canada introduced to require what was called, in shipping terms, continuous voyage. That is to say, if immigrants were to come to Canada, they had to come continuously from one location to another. Now, in the instance of the Komagata Maru, it had picked up various portions of its human cargo at different locations from India through the South China Seas to Hong Kong and then to Vancouver. This continuous voyage regulation, which was supported by orders and council of the Canadian government and the British government, has become a British imperial circuit of legal arrangements by this time, was designed to reduce the number of immigrants from South Asia and from East Asia, Chinese, Japanese, and in this case, South Asians, and particularly as to what we're speaking about today, the Sikhs. Since 1911, Ormsby continues, the number of Sikh immigrants in Canada had been limited by orders in council of the Sir Wilfrid Laurier government. And when these were found invalid by Chief Justice Gordon Hunter of the Supreme Court of British Columbia by special orders in council passed by the Borden government in 1913, which only applied to entry into British Columbia, the Komagata Maru, further, had been chartered by a Punjabi agitator in order to test the validity of this new embargo. Now, that is not well known in our history, that this was a test case. So the Komagata Maru had arrived. The immigration and customs officials refused to allow disembarkation and entry into Canada of East Asians. And for weeks, the local papers were filled with accounts of the attempts made by immigration officers to deport the unfortunate passengers. Case after case came into the courts, and as the time lengthened, the rations of the Sikhs, who were no longer supplied by the shipping company, became shorter and their plight more desperate. On the 19th of July, after the handing down of court decisions upholding the deportation orders, a miniature war broke out, with 175 local police and immigration officers who were intending to place the passengers on board the Empress of India for transportation to Hong Kong. They were repelled by pieces of coal, wood, brick, and steel hurled from the decks of the Komagata Maru. In the end, writes Ormsby, after assuring a committee of local Sikhs, which had arranged to take over the ship's charter, that compensation would be considered for its expenses, Martin Birrell, Minister of Agriculture in the Borden cabinet, succeeded in making arrangements for the departure of the ship. Now, I add here parenthetically that the harbor tugboats and water cannon of the fire department had been brought in to quench the activities of the Sikhs. The police could do nothing. If the local Sikh community was lobbying for the unification with their brothers and even a couple of families that were on board the Komagata Maru, and it was what one might describe as a very, very hot circumstance, very, very difficult for the authorities. The whole item, from a legal standpoint, is told, and I recommend this highly to persons who were interested in the government's position, the immigration officer's position on this, by the chief immigration officer in Vancouver. His name was Robbie Reed, R-O-B-B-I-E-R-E-I-D. He wrote a lengthy report from his standpoint that was published in the British Columbia Historical Quarterly. And you can find that by going through the British Columbia Historical Federation website and then chasing through to the British Columbia Historical Quarterly, and you will find through their index system Mr. Reed's important report. Reed was a lawyer. He had been educated at Dalhousie University. He was a close associate with Judge Howie, the famous historian, and he was also a close associate with Sir Richard McBride. All three of these fellows had been to Dalhousie Law School. I commend that argument to you because it speaks to the issue of if we're going to have laws in place, they should surely then be enforced. And the Sikhs on arrival in the Komagata Maru were there not as persons who had become shipwrecked, for instance, which would require boarding on land and some protection and asylum if necessary. They were seen, therefore, as illegal immigrants and not qualified to land. They didn't have the papers, so to speak. Now, the other side of the story we now have learned is that the regulations that were put in place in 1908 by the Laurier government at the instigation of William Lyon Mackenzie King, who'd come to Vancouver to look into the damages of the Chinese and the Japanese and uncovered the opium den story that I've talked about in another cauldron. His position was that this could not occur, could not happen, would not be allowed to put in place. In short, the Canadian government was putting through in its regulations a means of tightening the immigration numbers. So behind the Komagata Maru story is a larger story of trying to control Chinese and Japanese immigration. And in 1908, by what is called a gentleman's agreement, Canada and Japan made a deal to cut back the immigration numbers to the low hundreds. And furthermore, the Chinese were being more heavily licensed on arrival. That's a whole other history that ends in the famous 1923 Chinese Exclusion Act, which we've talked about before. Now, one of the comic circumstances of our story is that our own cruiser of the Royal Canadian Navy, HMCS Rainbow, is sent over under the command of Walter Hose to provide a convoy support to the authorities to make sure that the Komagata Maru leaves Vancouver Harbor. And historians of Riley said that this was the first important naval function of the ship, the Rainbow, the famous Rainbow. And 1 week later, conscious of a new and greater danger, that is to say, the possibility that the German cruiser Leipzig might make an attack on Vancouver, because war had in the interim been proclaimed on the 4th of August, that they should have protection from guns placed in Stanley Park and at Point Grey. News of the death of Archduke Franz Ferdinand was part of the constant discussion. Britain was going to war to defend Belgium and support France. Russia was involved, etc., etc. Now, just a few other things that make this into an even bigger story. First of all, it was little known in the 1960s. It had been heard about. Ormsby had written about it, but only tangentially. And a young professor at Simon Fraser University by the name of Hugh Johnson, who had written a book called Shoveling Out Paupers, which is about British immigration policy, asked myself what he might consider to be a suitable topic. Well, I said to him, why don't you look up the Komagata Maru affair? It's not been properly covered. And lo and behold, he did. And his book was subsequently published, and it's gone into more than one edition. Dr. Johnson learned the language and has written other things about the history of the South Asian people. Further, there is a South Asian Institute in the Fraser Valley, which is dedicated to telling the story of South Asians. The Sikhs have become very prominent in Canadian federal politics, and particularly in the Liberal Party and in the administration of Justin Trudeau. There were no less than six members of the cabinet who were of a Sikh background. The struggle for the evolution of a Khalistan within India has increased tensions between the mother state of India and its various minorities. I'm going to leave that story because it doesn't belong in our particularly Canadian context, but it is part of the larger general story. And Canada's relationships with India are not at all as stable as they used to be. And the reason for that is ethnicities, rival groups, rival ambitions lie at the heart of it. And it behooves Canadian diplomats to know the details of this and to act rather prudently. Incidentally, in reading the Canadian Encyclopedia story about the Komagata Maru, the Sikh community in British Columbia has now renamed the Komagata Maru and has given it a name that is a Sikh name. This does not square correctly with Lloyd's of London Registry, which reports in 1914 the ship in question to be the Komagata Maru. One cannot change this ex post facto, so to speak. Now, what happened to the persons who were obliged to sail away, escorted out of the harbor, out of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, destined back for East Asia? I can see this woebegone cargo of disappointed humans making their way, looking down the Strait of Juan de Fuca as they make their way past Cape Beale, looking out at the vast expanse of the Pacific Ocean and back to the seas that would eventually take them back to India. Well, the ship had started from a port near Calcutta, and that's where it was going to return. In fact, when it got back to that port near Kolkata, a violent confrontation occurred with the police, and there were some difficulties of disembarking the people there. I don't know the full details of what happened on Quayside in India upon the return, but I can tell you that there were 19 dead at the end of this fracas, and the 19 dead had this strange and long voyage to Burrard Inlet from India and then back to India. So there you have it. The Komagata Maru incident is a stark reminder of Canada's discriminatory immigration policies that led to it. This is the general view from 2025, and one can find that readily by doing a web search. But is it the whole story? No, it certainly is not the whole story. The rules and regulations had changed during the course of the passage from India to Canada. Furthermore, the papers were not correctly in line with what was required in Canada. Those had changed. The rules and regulations had changed during the passage. So it brings into the question as to whether or not the rules and regulations are correct at the time of departure or the time of arrival. Well, no state is going to accept the view that they have to be landed at the time, according to the rules and regulations, at the time they left India. But nonetheless, and in spite of this view about the legalities of things, which Robbie Reed had demonstrates in his magnificent discussion of this, it is now seen in 2025 in our own times as an act of discrimination. And in an age of apologies in which history is cast aside and apologies overcome this sort of thing. We've had this for many persons, the Ukrainian Canadians, the Dukhobors, the Chinese, the Japanese, and now in this case, the Sikhs, and there are others as well. It's partial atonement, I suppose, and recognition of the fact that our current years here in the second coming into the second quarter of the 21st century are rather different from what they were in the early decades of the 20th century and the previous few decades of the 19th century. And this brings up an interesting question for all students of history. How do we put our minds back into the times of when these acts occurred? How do we continue to appreciate the difficulties of all the actors that were involved in the saga of that time? And how do we not deal with it in those terms and then come to deal with it with understanding and sympathy in terms of what it's like in the middle of the 21st century as it now is approaching? The Parliament in of Canada in 2016 makes a formal apology. And there is a beautiful memorial that has been set up with the names of the 376 persons engraved in it. It's down on the waterfront in Vancouver, within sight of the location in which this incident was occurred. It was very strongly one which involved the local press, and the local press, Province and the Sun and their similar newspapers of the age, were very strongly of the opinion that these unfortunate people should not be admitted into Canada. There was a lobby group and, of course, lawyers that were doing their bidding who were of the opinion that Canada's law should allow these people to come in as refugees, and that they had the right papers and had come under the right arrangements. In behind the scene on this is the great promoter who exercises the power over this sort of thing and organizes it, as I said before, as a test case in order to see if more and more East Asians can be admitted to British Columbia. I suppose one is always interested in what Canada's Historic Sites and Monuments Board says. This is the current view on it. This incident continues to resonate in our history and is a symbol of the early struggle of South Asian Canadians for justice and equality. Well, I think that's a fairly good estimation, and I'm going to repeat it. This incident continues to resonate in our history and is a symbol of the early struggle of South Asian Canadians for justice and equality. In point of fact, these people were looking for places to work and to live. And the Sikh community was very strong in agricultural capacities and in forestry capacities, and they in their early activities that have continued to this very time, the evolution of communities that were working around an economic model. It might be the raising of berries or certain fruits, or it could be in lumber mills or in the harvesting of certain commodities. These were very important contributions to the Canadian and British Columbia economic circumstances. And to this day, these communities thrive in sections in Vancouver Island and also in the southern, in the Fraser Valley, and particularly in Surrey. The Sikh community is also strong in Calgary, as a very large component there, and in other parts of Canada. Their contribution to the Canadian economy and the strength of the country is undoubtedly very strong. They're people who make excellent soldiers and service personnel and police as well. They have made a very important contribution to the Canadian mosaic, and but their story in the origins and developments, and particularly in the highlight of this episode of July of 1914, continue to resonate and continue to fascinate. So thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cauldron. We will continue to explore and develop aspects of the remarkable history of the province of British Columbia in the period from 1871 to 1914. I'm signing off, and thank you very much. I'm Barry Goff.